evening, everyone.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining me for another segment of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Happy belated Thanksgiving to everyone. I hope everyone's having a safe one. And I'd like to say tonight, listen, it is hard to book guests the weekend of Thanksgiving. So we're not having guests tonight. We're actually going to rebroadcast a very popular show. This show, in fact, is the most listened to show in Center Stage history. It's the show in which Leonard Padilla first appeared on Center Stage, and the show was titled The Casey Anthony Tell-All by Leonard Padilla. And Leonard Padilla, if you're not familiar with him, is the bounty hunter who first posted the bail for Casey Anthony after her first arrest, because I think there were at least three arrests. But he was the bounty hunter who first posted her bail, and I believe it was a $50,000 bail that he posted for her. That show was the most, by far, the most popular show, the most listened to show in Center Stage history. And the guests on that panel were bounty hunter Leonard Padilla himself, attorney Bobby Edmonds, and also Dr. Zoe Spencer. So I'm going to play that for you tonight. Sit back, enjoy the show. Get you something to drink. It was a very spirited show, I must admit. A lot of theories going on out there, a lot of people telling what they thought happened. And so that got a lot of people going and a lot of people very upset. So like I said, it was a very spirited show. By far, not a boring minute in the entire show. It was from beginning to end, just full of fireworks. So I'm going to begin now with the show titled Leonard Padilla, Casey Anthony Tell-All, Part 1. Be just a second and we'll get started. Computer's taking a second to come up. And we're going to go in about 15 seconds. Okay. Here we go.
It all starts with a Windows 7 PC.
I'll do that. We're going to play it.
Love Hope Radio.
Thank you.
thank you for coming center stage tonight. For our topic, we're talking about the Casey Anthony trial. We're going to be talking with bounty hunter Leonard Padilla, attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer, and Oklahoma criminal attorney Anthony McKesson. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Tonight we're going to be talking about the trial. Do you believe that Jose Baez and his defense team won, or do you believe the prosecution failed to lay out a timeline and definitively tell us what happened to cause the death of Kaylee Anthony? Did the prosecution fail to tell us the who, the what, the when, the where, and the how of Kaylee's disappearance for 31 days? And did the Anthonys, George, Lee, and Casey Anthony all managed to turn the trial into a case of who done it and what done it, therefore confusing the jury, which resulted in Casey being found not guilty? Well, tonight we're going to play the 911 tape, as well as hopefully lay out a timeline to track what happened from the point Kaylee was first reported missing. At this time, I'm going to introduce my panel. But before I do, I want to remind you that the views and opinions of my guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or the host. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you a California bounty hunter, the one who posted the $500,000 bail that first got Casey Anthony out of jail. That's Mr. Leonard Padilla. Also, we have attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer, and Oklahoma criminal attorney Mr. Anthony McKesson. Good evening, everyone. I'm going to open your phone lines. Good evening, everyone. Good evening.
This is Leonard Padilla in California. Good evening, folks.
Nay. Do I have Mr. McKesson on the phone? Okay. I've opened somebody's phone line incorrectly then. Do I have Bobby Edmonds on the line?
Yes, on the line.
Okay.
Good evening,
then
everyone.
I'm going to find Dr. Zoe Spencer. Dr. Zoe Spencer, are you on the line?
I'm here. Good evening, Carrie.
Good evening. Okay, you all. So we're going to start with Mr. Padilla. Mr. Padilla, tell us what you believe happened to Kaylee Anthony. What happened to little Kaylee?
Okay, on the night of the 15th of June, Casey returned home, and her mother had been at her father's rest home with the child. There was a discussion about $320-some that were missing from Cindy's mother's account that Casey had transferred to an AT&T bill in order to keep her phone hooked up. The argument got very serious enough to where the neighbors could hear the discussion and the fight that ensued, and also the fact that Cindy got so upset that she actually physically grabbed Casey around the neck and was actually choking her. Now, prior to that time, Cindy had been swimming in the pool with her daughter, granddaughter, and as Casey came home, they prepared her for bed. When the fight got so upset, Casey went to her bedroom. The mother was still very upset, and it was like Casey was going to go to bed and everything was cool. But what she did, in fact, was dress her daughter, except for shoes and socks. And as soon as Cindy was asleep, or at least Casey thought she was asleep, she snuck out of the house and got in the car. Now, she had a serious problem with Tony Lazaro, who ran the club. She could not take the child to Lazaro's residence in the evening, at night. She could take her during the day, as long as she was there and available to watch her, but she could not have her come there at night if Casey intended to sleep over. Therefore, on several occasions prior to this, she had learned how to make chloroform and had put the child to sleep. The reason she learned how to make chloroform is because she no longer had the ability or the financial wherewithal to buy Xanax, which was, according to what I learned back there in 2008, a common situation for putting children to sleep instead of some of the other more common things. But she was broke, had no money, no job, running out of gas constantly, and therefore had turned to chloroform. It had worked several times. There was no problem. We talked to people that were her friends where she actually had the child, had parties, and the child would sleep right through the parties.
But you have, she had to make the chloroform, right?
Excuse me?
She had to make the chloroform.
Right, which is really quite simple to make. The chloroform got banned in the United States back in the 70s because it was so dangerous and so volatile.
Uh-huh.
Children have a way of going around and they smell something, they hold it up to their nose and smell it. One good whiff of chloroform and a child is dead. When I was stationed in Arizona, we used to use it to pump into some holes outside the base to make the rattlesnakes somewhat lethargic. We didn't want to say we were killing them because then we'd have all sorts of problems, but because that kept them from crawling onto the base during the day looking for shade under the aircraft. But in this particular situation, she recognized that at about 2 in the morning after she had given her the chloroform and was getting back in the car, the child was lifeless. She put her in the car seat. She basically felt at that time that she was dead, didn't really know what to do, and drove around till about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. At which time, she went to Lazaro's house. This is the morning of the 16th, parked the car at the far end of the parking lot where Lazaro lives. I went up the apartment, spent some time there. They then that evening went and got some movies. She spent the night there. The next morning, she borrowed his Jeep. She didn't want to drive her car because she had the child wrapped in a blanket in the trunk of the car. She borrowed the Jeep on the morning of the 17th, went to the Sawgrass Apartments after she'd been over to see another friend of hers that morning. He was busy helping his mother. She then went to the Sawgrass Apartments where Dante is. At that time, she saw Zenaida standing by her New York-plated Kia Silver, not a Ford Focus, but a Silver Kia. She mistook it as a Ford Focus because her previous boyfriend, Ricardo Morales, owned a Ford Focus, silver in color.
Okay, are we talking about Zenaida, Zanny the Nanny?
Correct, Zanny the Nanny.
Okay.
She pays attention to the fact that this lady's got a couple of kids. Goes up to the office. She knows the young gentleman that handles the office during the day. Says, hey, who's that lady? She's a lady that's looking to rent an apartment. She's getting divorced. She's got two children. And she actually takes down the information. The next day, she goes back to the house with her child in the trunk of the car, borrows the shovel from the neighbor. Her intention is to bury the child next to the dollhouse in the backyard. The dirt's too hard. She doesn't have the ability to work that hard. So then, she decides, okay, I will wrap the child in a couple plastic bags and a laundry bag, put tape on the child's mouth. When the child is, the body is found, it'll be a kidnapping that went wrong or whatever. Puts the child back in the trunk of the car. She drives around until the 24th when her dad's looking for his gas can. The 24th, she panics and does what is commonly referred to in the business as a panic dump. She drives down to the end of the street, makes a right-hand turn at the dead end, into the bushes, gets the child out. By this time, in the Florida sun, the child is nothing but 35 pounds of what you might call liquid bones and stew. As she's pulling the body out of the trunk, the bag rips. So now you have horrible decomposition all over her and the car, the trunk. As she turns around and takes a step, she trips over some building blocks that are there, and the body just kind of falls out of her hands and rolls up against what you might call a log or a piece of tree that is laying there. All of this is within 19 feet from the exact edge of the road to where the body ended up laying. If you take the mowing strip, which is a 5-foot wide strip, and take 5-foot width of the car, that takes 10 feet, and take another 5 feet to where she tripped over the blocks, the building blocks, the body was 4 foot inside the building blocks. That's where the body rested from that time, June 24th, until December the 11th, when Quant found the body.
Okay. So that's Mr. Padilla's version of what he thinks happened. Now, my question is, how did you come up with those facts? Or how do you believe that this is what happened?
A lot of the facts came from Casey's own mouth to Tracy, who lived with her for 9 days.
Okay, and Tracy was who? She was the person that was hired by you to watch her because you had posted the bail?
Yes, Tracy has worked for me for many, many, many years. Tracy has got experience in many areas of the work that we do, which is locating fugitives, locating lost people, and sometimes locating murderers before they've even been charged.
Okay.
So there's a tremendous amount of experience in her. There's a tremendous amount of experience, and Rob Dick, who was the deputy sheriff for the Sacramento County Sheriff's Office.
Mm-hmm.
He then came to work for me almost 20 years ago and has probably 4,000 arrests to his credit.
Robert Dick was over security, correct?
He was in charge of security.
Okay. And your nephew was the actual...
My nephew, Tony Padilla, is a bail agent in California.
Right. Okay, so he's the one that actually posted the bond.
He's the one that I said, hey, I'll pay you the $50,000 if you'll go to Florida with us and post the bond. He then contacted Al Estes, who works for the same company that he does out of Houston, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and had Al Estes post the bond for him because you have to be licensed through Florida. And he's the one that actually posted the bond when Casey Anthony got out, yes.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, now that's Mr. Padilla's facts about work, or that's what he believes happened. We're going to ask our other two guests what they believe happened, then we're going to go into the timeline, and we're going to also play the 911 tape tonight because we're going to try to reconstruct what we think happened. We, you know, there's no way of definitively knowing, but Wikipedia has a timeline, and so did CFNews13.com. And so we're going to kind of go back and forth off the timelines that I see on both of those sites, and we're going to kind of try to figure out what we think happened because I think what I noticed in this particular trial was I think everybody got confused about the facts. When I say everyone, I think I'm speaking of the jury. I think they got very confused with all the different scenarios that were thrown out there, and they just said, okay, that poses reasonable doubt, so therefore we can't convict her.
Can I make a statement?
Yes, sir.
Okay, here's one of the problems. Now, let me give you a little background on me, okay?
Okay.
I'm a young guy that went to five different high schools in California, worked in the fields, Mexican families, immigrants. I went in the Air Force when I was 17. I was lucky enough to be bright enough to get picked for a special unit that went to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We worked in Libya. We worked in Egypt. We worked in all the countries of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I had come out of the military, I knew two things. I knew how to kill and I knew how to think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are things that, you know, where do you put these items to work that you become real good at? Well, I went to law school under the GI Bill. And under the GI Bill, I went to Lincoln Law School and I got my degree in 1980. Now, 2 years after I graduated, I noticed that there was a lot of Mexican people, folks like myself, that didn't go to law school because they didn't have the money.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough to go under GI. So in 1982, I started the University of Northern California, Lorenzo Patino Law School, later renamed for a good friend of mine, Judge Patino, who died of leukemia in 1983. So it's the Lorenzo Patino Law School. In this school are individuals that are very street savvy, very street wise. But most of them, I've had to help get GEDs in my school to get them into the paralegal program, to get them into the law school program, to get them past the CLEP, the college level equivalency program.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very bright, and I brag about it, very bright and very intuitive. I know how to think. A lot of people think, well, I know how to think. Everybody knows how to think. No, until a fellow by the name of Lieutenant Barak took me aside in the Air Force, and basically said, I want to teach you how to think. I did not realize I didn't know how to think at the time. But one thing I do know is how to think, and I teach all the students and all of the professors that teach at my law school. The first thing you must know about law is how to think. One of the things that happened was Baez, who I consider to be a good friend and a stellar attorney, did not win the case.
Okay.
Ashton lost it.
Okay.
Ashton lost it because he was afraid of certain facts. He didn't want to put the fight with Cindy Anthony into evidence because he thought that would create a question mark about Cindy Anthony, who he wanted to be a witness of his. He also didn't put George Anthony under the spotlight when he lied about seeing the child leave the house the very next day on the 16th. He didn't see her leave with the child on the 16th because she left the night before. That was a lie. But Cindy and George concocted that because they didn't want to look like anything less than a stellar family. Ashton knew all of these things, but he didn't do anything about the fight, and he didn't call George about him not seeing that child the next day. He also didn't put Tracy on the stand, who lived with Casey.
For 9 days after she was released from jail the first time.
9 days, 24/7. Those two women bonded, and today... Tracy has said it a dozen times, if not more than that, except for the fact of what she did. I love that girl.
Wow.
She's like my soul sister.
And you know what? That's one thing that I noticed, that Casey obviously has a very winning personality, because I could tell, and I think I said this to Dr. Zoe Spencer, that her. And she was like, they bonded with her, and they really, you know, worked hard to get her out of this. But we're going to go to attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds. Attorney Edmonds, what do you think happened? You followed the trial. What do you think happened?
Well, I followed the trial, but there were, you definitely really couldn't connect Casey. The way it was presented, there were so many loopholes in connecting the evidence to Casey. Additionally, when you look at trying to see what time period did this child actually die, and of course they tried to use the scientific evidence, but that didn't link any DNA to Casey. The things that Mr. Padillo is saying, those things didn't really come out in court, and of course, even if the fight was pending and come out, it's going to further show that that was a dysfunctional family, and when the parties were testifying, it appears that they weren't as credible as they should have been, particularly the father. So you see that there, either they were covering up something or there was something within their family that they did not want to be disclosed. So they didn't make very good witnesses, I didn't think, for the prosecution. And a defense attorney only has to prove that there's reasonable doubt. To the level of the jurors would say, we have some serious problems here. It doesn't have to be, and it depends on the factual circumstances. So the jurors here did not include all the high publicity out there, because if it was in public opinion, it would have been found guilty. But I assessed the case before the jury actually rendered the verdict, and I was telling people, they're going to find her not guilty on the charges, but they will find her guilty on something less, possibly the misdemeanor. And that's what happened later on that day, because I could not see how, if the jurors did look at all the evidence that was as presented, there were doubts. There was credibility issues with the father, testimony. Mother gets up there and says she did some research on the computer with the chloroform. You have some doubts being built. And that's really all the prosecution had to do. They didn't have to put Casey on the stand. They really didn't have to call a single witness. But they chose to call witnesses because it was necessary, with this high-profile case, to call some witnesses at least.
Okay.
We don't even know now. How did the baby die? How did she? We know there was tape allegedly over her face. We know that chloroform was allegedly involved. I hear Mr. Padilla says that Casey had a practice of putting the baby to sleep with the chloroform.
Sure.
Well, where did she get this from? Did her mother do that when she was a little child? I don't know. There are so many issues with the family that stem a surface to me. And so really don't know, but we know what was presented in court. And all the judge could do is rule on the issues of law, on the objections. All the defense attorney could do is use what he had and the strategy of not calling certain witnesses. That was his strategy, good or bad.
Let me see if I can inject some here.
Okay. Yes.
One of the problems that Ashton had, and I'm glad you've got a judge on this show, was that on about the second or the third visit that Baez had with Casey at the jail, the conversation was overheard by one of the investigators in the case. Every time that Baez went to visit Casey, the investigation team was contacted.
Oh,
I think it was the third time. I think it was about the third time Baez, she related the drowning of the child in the pool, and the dad and her making the body down around the corner and placing the body where it was found. She related that to Baez. Law enforcement heard it.
Mm.
Now, law enforcement, as the judge can tell you, had a predicament in their hands.
Yes.
They cannot listen to the conversation, therefore, they cannot do anything other than, what do we do? We know where the body is. How do we find the body? The media would have
turned it would have been suppressed. That type of evidence would have been suppressed because they violated a right in eavesdrop. So you're alluding to the fact somebody
somebody tipped off the meter reader to where the body was so that he could go and discover the body.
Let me walk it backwards for you.
Okay.
In the latter part of August, when Tim Miller was there, on the 26th or the 27th, I think it was the 27th, the same day that something else happened, he was told by one of the investigators, the lead investigator, I've got you $5,000, don't leave town, because Tim was getting, he was leaving town. He was leaving. He got in a big row with Cindy over the searching of the body. Cindy said the child's alive. He's saying she's, you know, possibly deceased. Tim was there because my nephew, Tony Padilla, posted the bond, had contacted Cindy and told her, get a hold of Tim Miller in Texas. All right, Tim's leaving town. This cop comes and says, don't leave, don't leave. I've got you $5,000 from the sheriff's special fund. Go search by the school, which is basically where the body was. Okay. Tim doesn't find the body. Subsequently, I asked Tim, why didn't you search where the body was? He says, Leonard, it was 4 to 10 foot of water there, which it was. Hurricane Faye had come in there and made that a big pond, a huge pond.
But it's Tim again, it's who?
Tim Miller. He runs Equisir.
Okay, got it.
Out of Texas.
Okay.
He didn't want to lose his equipment. He made a cursory search of there, that place and other places, including Jay Blanchard, and left town. Subsequently, there was a situation that arose where, what do we do? How do we find the body without being connected to it? Well, this one gentleman says, wait a minute, Michelle Carpentier, she's in the detention side of the jail. She works in the jail. Her boyfriend is a meter reader, but he works across town. Now, look up when Roy Cronk was transferred to that area.
So the meter reader did not always work that particular area. He was transferred to that area.
Correct. Now, you look up when he was transferred.
His girlfriend works at the jail.
Yes, okay. Michelle Carpentier worked at the jail. Now, if you form a mental picture of the area where the body was found, when I first heard where the body was found, I remembered that there was a place, but I just couldn't see why a water meter reader would be in that area. Because there isn't a single house along there. There's no houses, no water meters, nothing. It's just a stretch of swamp.
So legitimately, he had no reason to be there.
Zero reason to be there.
Wow.
Now, on August the 11th, why is he talking about bones? You've heard the 11th and the 12th and the 13th of August, those phone calls?
Yes.
Why is he talking about bones? Skull?
So you're talking about what the meter reader said to 911?
No, he said it to his dispatch.
Okay, he said it to his dispatch. Okay, gotcha.
August 11th, 12th, and 13th. Listen to those calls in detail. On the 11th of August, there was no mention by law enforcement of anything publicly that included a body. They were looking for a missing child, period. Well, how did law enforcement then privately know they were looking for a body?
Okay. So he would have had to overheard the conversation to know that it was no longer a missing child, that it was a body.
On the 11th of August.
Wow. It appears that, so you're indicating that there was a cover-up.
Wait a minute. He talks about what he calls a pool cover. There was a pool cover, a great pool cover, a striped pool cover. Listen to the calls. That is not a pool cover. It's one of these big umbrella tents that the wind has rolled up against the brush. But when you look at it from 30 foot away, it looks like something that might be a pool cover, but it's not. It's an umbrella all rolled up. It's still there. As of 2 weeks ago when I was there, it was still there.
So did Mr. Cronk collect the reward money?
I think he eventually got $15,000 for the picture of the snake, which was not a snake that he picked up. It was a snake that David Dean, there were three meter readers that were there that morning. Not one, three.
Now,
the snake was picked up by David Dean. Subsequently, there was a big thing about the snake, the snake, the snake. I set about, I figured, okay, I called David Dean, I says, where's the snake? In my freezer. I called the FBI. I told them, the FBI should check that snake. Well, why should we? I says, hey, you know, this is after the body had been found. I says, there's talk about chloroform. Maybe the snake stuck its head in the bag and got up with the chloroform. Who knows? So they went out, searched the search warrant, got the snake. They still have the snake in evidence.
Wow.
There were things that came up that Ashton didn't even don't want to get close to. Remember at one time when Baez or somebody's asking somebody, I think it was Hoover, regarding the pictures that he'd offered to somebody for sale?
Mm-hmm.
That was me he offered them to. After the body was found,
really?
On I think the 13th or the 14th of December, he says, hey, Leonard, you want to buy some pictures? I figured, no, cops are trying to set me up. I don't want no part of it. Finally, he showed them to me, and I said, you better get a hold of Nick Savage with the FBI. He'd be very interested in why you guys were out there on the 14th or 15th of November, exactly 72 feet away from where the body was, which is where Crunk was, exactly 72 feet away on the 11th, 12th, and 13th of August. The reason he was 72 feet away, remember when I told you she stepped out of the car? She had the stuff dripping all over her.
She tripped herself.
Took two steps and tripped over some building blocks?
Right.
When she's telling Baez that she tripped over the building blocks, that's key. Because if you go 72 feet from where the body was found, there's a stack of building blocks there. But these are in plain sight, right by the edge of the road, in plain sight, not hidden in the grass like the ones she tripped over.
Well, yeah, we got so much to get to. We got to get to the 911 tape. We got to put this timeline together. And also, we want to hear from Dr. Zoe Spencer. Dr. Zoe Spencer, what do you think happened?
Sherry,
so did we lose you? Okay, I think we've got a connection problem with Dr. Zoe.
Can you, Sherry, I'm
you here.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. What do you think happened?
Okay.
What happened to Kaylee Anthony?
You know, I'm listening to Mr. Padillo, and I have to admit that I did not follow the trial as closely as other people followed it, and I really just got in on the tail end of the discussion, and I'm listening to him, and he seems to have a lot of information that was not presented. You know, I have to speculate on it because, you know, as we've kind of discussed, I have my own hypothesis, you know, about what happened. One of my concerns is even in listening to the 911 tape, and I know that we're going to get to that at some point, you know, it seems like everybody is regurgitating the things that were presented. Mr. Padillo seems to have some additional information, but it seems like everyone is regurgitating the chain of events that were recorded by Casey's mother and her father. And, you know, I really question whether or not those accounts are true. I really have some serious questions, and I guess I'm the naysayer. Everyone is talking about chloroform. You know, I don't see where chloroform entered the picture. Mr. Padillo made mention about that Casey had used forms of putting Kaylee to sleep before, but I don't remember anybody taking the stand to attest to that, so... you know, I really have questions about whether or not the chain of events as reported by Cindy Anthony and her father are actually accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and as do a lot of people. You
I think that's what I'm
going to take. We're going to play it now. And you all decide for yourself, and I'd like to discuss this, discuss the tape afterwards, because I hear a whole lot in this 911 tape, which I think is, and this is, the voices that you'll hear is Casey Anthony and Cindy Anthony talking to a female 911 operator. And I think this really pretty much sets the stage for how the rest of the investigation went after this. Okay, here we go.
911, what's your emergency?
Thank you.
If you're about to tattletale on somebody or accuse someone of murdering their child,
was very, very staged. And I don't know what happened 31 days ago, but to me it's kind of clear that Kaylee died 31 days from that phone call.
Let me interject something. 31 days from that phone call is the 15th of June. 30 days from that phone call is the 16th of June when George said she walked out of the house with the baby. Now, did you notice how Casey always talks about a nanny? We all have babysitters. She's got a nanny.
I'm not questioning, because it was very evident to me watching her, looking at her and then reading the things that I did read. It was very, very obvious to me that, if I had to invoke a diagnosis without having assessed her myself, that she's definitely a pathological liar. However, I sincerely question whether or not the account that was given by her mother and father, whether they were accurate. And I think everybody wrote on that, because everything is kind of based on what they stated. And we're not sure that that's the actual chain of events. Perhaps an accident did happen. Chloroform. People jumped into this chloroform debate when the guy said that the mom or his little software recorded that they had searched for chloroform 84 times. And I know that you said in your comment and in your opening that, this was the chain of events and she could not afford Xanax and da-da-da. Well, you can go and get Benadryl and give a child 2 Benadryl and knock them out. So you don't
exactly.
Need to concoct
Benadryl is a common use. Yes.
Right. So you don't have to concoct a potion of chloroform of all things to make your child go to sleep. There are a host of over-the-counter supplies that will put children to sleep.
Let me see. You're a doctor. Let me jump in here with this. Listen to the terminology that Casey uses, and it might give you a hint. In other words, you're a doctor. You're trained in that area. She uses a nanny. She doesn't have a babysitter. She talks about using resources. She talks about using other assets in searching for the child. She throws in this supposed phone call that afternoon on the 15th.
Right.
She's
very,
as you said, very adept liar, but she uses terminology. She does things that are out of the norm.
Connected with her injury or missing.
Was that maybe so trying to see what was possibly going to be supposedly the story, and then some kind of way they got through in the tailspin and that story kind of unraveled? But maybe the car being reported missing, because I guess I'm confused, Mr. Padilla, about the car. The car cannot be missing and Cindy Anthony saying at the same time that she smelled death in the car. Is the car missing?
Okay, watch this. Remember on the 24th when she drove around the corner,
yes,
dumped the body? Okay. Now, she ripped the bag and she got decomposition on herself. That's the clothes that Cindy washed. And she got decomposition in the trunk of the car. That was a horrible smell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's driving around in the car on the 27th, 2 days later,
mm-hmm,
3 days later. She says to her friend, Amy, well, my dad borrowed the car, ran over some animals, and I got this terrible smell in the car.
Mm-hmm.
The same evening, the 27th, on a Friday night, she parks it next to the dumpster at the Amscot and says she ran out of gas, just kind of walks away from it, okay? Just literally walks away from the car. Now, the car got towed on the 30th. Mrs. Sanchez, the manager there, calls on Monday morning. She's seen that car for 3 days parked there. She calls the tow yard. The tow yard comes, tows the car off. Gentleman at the tow yard testified there was the death smell in the car. But here's what happens. The notice gets sent out on the 4th of July, or the 5th of July, I believe, to the Anthonys. They don't use their front door when they come and go. They always click the garage door up, drive into the garage door, lower the door, and go in through the kitchen from the garage.
Okay,
they
well, the media says that they found that notice on the 13th.
They found it on the 15th.
Okay, well, okay. Wikipedia.
But that's only because they never used the front door to go in and out of that house. Even when we were there, they would drive in the garage, put the door down behind their vehicle, and walk in the kitchen door. Very seldom did they use the front door, which is where the notice was put, on the front door of the house. On the 15th, George is out there puttering around in the yard, and he sees this thing in the door, and he goes over there and he pulls it. And he's very upset, very aggravated, because it's not the first time he's had to go to a tow yard and recover the car, because she's run out of gas, left it on the side of the freeway or in a neighborhood, and they've towed the car and stored it, and it costs him $200-$300 every time. So he's very aggravated. Why does he take a gas can with him when he goes to the yard? Well, because he knows, he figures he's going to need gas. Now, does he have gas in the can at the time, or does he have to go fill the gas can? I don't know. I forgot what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But when he's there, George has been a homicide detective in Ohio for 10 years, homicide.
Mm-hmm.
He has smelled decomposing bodies.
Mm-hmm.
When he nears the car, he knows that there's decomposition there. Once you smell decomposition, you never, ever forget it. Cindy might not, as well as a nurse should, know decomposition, but George knows there's decomposition. What did he say? I thought it was either my daughter or my granddaughter, and I was praying that it wasn't either one. When he looks in the trunk and he sees garbage in there, his mind clicks, oh my God, thank you, Lord, it's not my daughter or my granddaughter. They take the car home, but George, in the back of his mind, knows there's decomposition. When the cops come to the house, the cops that walk through the garage where the car is, know there's decomposition.
Okay, remind us again what day this is.
On the 16th.
Of July.
There was cops there the night of the 15th, and there was cops there on the 16th. 16th is when they went on the big tour. They went to the Sawgrass Apartments. They went to where the Gloria, the mother of this babysitter, was supposed to be. They went out to the studios.
Universal.
And finally they got tired of chasing their tail, and they arrested her. Now, the cops were sitting there saying there's decomposition. I mean, there's no way the cops are thinking the child's alive, but there's decomposition in front of the car. They, in their own mind, have got a woman that is lying to them about where their daughter is, and there's decomposition smells. You know, the child's dead. She was in the trunk of the car. They're not going to jump up and say this. They've got a messy case on their hands already, because this young lady is an accomplished liar. When I met her, the very next day after I met her, we were sitting on the couch. We were sitting there talking, just talking about just general things.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that she was lying about things she didn't have to lie about. And I told her, Casey, when you get through this, and you will get through it, you are going to get through it, you come see me and I'll give you a job in the work I do, because I need accomplished liars. Did she get up and get upset at me or anything? No, she just giggled and looked at me. She says, for real? I said, yes.
Wow. Okay, y'all, we gotta play catch up. I'm gonna go to the meter readers dispatch call about the body of Kaylee Anthony. We also want to deal with the timeline, and we got a couple phone calls we got to get to y'all. But before I do that, if you just tuned in, you've come center stage tonight. We're talking about the Kaylee Anthony case. We're talking to bounty hunter Leonard Padilla, Fort Worth attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, and sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer. If you're on the phone lines and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening in via the Internet, dial us up at 347-850-8390. And again, press 1. A reminder, the chat room is open tonight. So if you have a question or a comment, you can post up in the chat room. If you would, put it in red so I can see it quickly when I glance into the chat room throughout the night. Also, tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.africanamericannewsandcommentary.com. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is also being brought to you by Daily Deposits for the Soul, your daily guide to enriching your soul and improving your mind in just 15 minutes a day. They're located on the web at www.dailydepositsforthesoul.com. Okay, y'all, let's go to this dispatch call, or this meter reader's call to his dispatch about what happened with him finding this bag that he thinks is Mr. Here we go.
Well, back behind
of the road, not in the brush.
I'm sorry, this is part two.
The information has passed from the eavesdropping officer to another officer who passes it on to Michelle Carpentier, who passes it on to her boyfriend, the meter reader, that is assigned on the 11th of August to go to that area. But when he goes and looks for the building blocks, which is where the starting point is for the hunt, he is 72 feet off in the distance. The Diamondback was on the edge of the road, which was picked up by David Dean, not him. He didn't have to go out into the bushes. He's talking stuff to get somebody out there to locate this body. Later on, when the body was located, if you listen to his call and his testimony, he says the body was in this bag. He kicked the bag, the skull rolled out. Here, he's looking at the skull out in the open, he says. He's been told certain things, but listen to this. On the 11th, 12th, and 13th, there is no public outcry about a body. It's a missing person. It's a missing child. Only law enforcement knows the child is dead.
Okay, now this is August 11th, 12th, and 13th.
Correct, August. In other words, at that time, there's no outcry about a missing, about a dead child. It's a missing child, and the only people that know that the child is dead is Casey, her attorney, and the cops.
And her mother and father and brother.
Not at that time.
And the meter reader.
Not at that time. The meter reader knows, but her brother and the father and the mother do not know on the 11th, 12th, and 13th of August that the child is deceased.
Okay, let's go to the phone line.
They have a strong hunch.
Yeah, a strong hunch.
The smell in the car.
Let's go to the phone line. Area code 415-206. Good evening. You're on center stage. Good evening.
Oh, that's you.
Oh, yes. Hi, that's me. Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay,
good evening.
Hi.
You're on center stage.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. I'm Ruth. And give me my questions, honey. Okay, so, all right. My question is, I wanted to get to the trial. Maybe I'm getting ahead of things.
No, just start out there. Cause
wait a minute. I have another, a more pressing question.
Okay, go ahead.
I got to put this tactfully. Why is, if Mr. Padilla is telling everything right now, doesn't that compromise the ability of Casey to tell everything and make money? And if Mr. Padilla is suing her, isn't he shooting himself in the foot by compromising her ability to make money by telling this story?
Why would he care about her making money?
Well, because he's suing her.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Okay.
The truth coming out is more important than any kind of money that anybody could make off of these facts. It's more important.
I mean, but there's an outcry caller from the world wanting to know the truth about this. So don't you think it's good that there's a good guy out there who's telling what really happened? I mean, he was on the ground. He met with the family. He talked with Casey. You know, he talked with her mother. He talked with her father. Don't you really want to know from somebody that was on the inside what really happened during those days that they were searching for Kaylee?
Well, this was not all brought up in court, and so of course Casey did take the stand. The parents did not allude to a lot of things that Mrs. Maria is saying, and they don't understand, and no lawyers brought out all of that stuff during the trial.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point in time, your testimony or your version was not actually sworn to in court, I understand that you have some vital facts that were not even introduced in court and could have made the difference on the decision for the jury.
But here's the thing, and the good judge will tell you this. Had Ashton put either myself, Rob, or any of the seven people that were there that had talked to that family day in and day out for 9 days, it might have led to a discussion about how the body was eventually discovered. And did law enforcement overhear a conversation?
Carrie, can I interject? I'll throw that case out. If the prosecutors knew that their investigators and their law enforcement officials conducted an illegal search and they pursued a capital case against this girl, then the prosecutors would have violated their oath of office. If that comes out that they are intentionally trying to get a capital case against her and their own investigators that were dirty. And so it's some cover up that could have been charges brought against them. But that was really, that's not the case here.
Why? Why isn't it the case?
Well, because, Mr. Padilla, you know that, but the judge didn't know it, the jurors didn't know it, it did come out in testimony.
Right, because they started, because remember the first...
It did come out that the prosecutors knew that their law enforcement office, if this in fact happened, if they knew that their law enforcement officers eavesdropped or violated their constitutional right to privacy or to conversation between attorney-client in a jail facility, and then, fashioned a way to discover that body on acquired information, then you don't have a big scandal surrounding that case.
Absolutely. But remember, where Ashton started the trial? With the call, not from Kronk on the 11th, 12th, and 13th, not from Kronk on the 11th of December, but with dispatch. Dispatch calling 911. The water meter readers dispatch calling 911 is where Ashton started the trial. He didn't start with any one of the seven people that were living with Casey that Casey spoke to very openly, consistently, every day on a daily basis. He didn't start with the calls from Kronk on the 11th, 12th, and 13th, or even Kronk's call in December. He was very deceptive in starting the trial with the call from the dispatcher of the water people to 911. Therefore, staying away from anything that led up to the discovery of the body.
Okay, Dr. Lee, you were trying to say something a few minutes ago?
Listen, I am about to burst. it is very clear that the dispatcher knew where the body was and knew that there was a body in it. In the brush or whatever. I mean, there are two things. There's an involved reaction, an attached reaction, and then there's a detached reaction. He calls three times, and it's very, very clear that he is trying to herd law enforcement to this area. And then he even makes reference and alludes to, well, what if there's a body? And he also thinks numerous times, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, but it just doesn't look right to me. So it's very clear that he knows that there's a body. And I don't know if I heard it correctly in the beginning, if he mentioned Anthony or not, but I thought in the first tape he actually started out the conversation by mentioning the case or something. I don't know if I misheard that. But I just
think he mentioned their address in the area that their home was on that street or near the area.
Right. So I definitely think that he knew, and I do agree with Mr. Padillo that someone had to have given him that information. However, Mr. Padillo, and I don't want to, make it a debate because I have my own hypothesis about, the circumstances and nobody wants to hear it. But ultimately, he said that only Casey, her attorney, and the crew knew what happened to Kaylee. I disagree with that. I really think that her parents were definitely involved. In the 911 call tape between her mom and Casey, you can hear her mother coaching her in the background. And there's something that we call detached affect in psychosocial terms. And that's when somebody removes themselves from a situation. And Casey is very, very detached in that phone call. However, she is very attached to the 31 days, which I believe, based on that, was the day her daughter died. I definitely disagree that chloroform had anything to do with it. I think all of that has been disproven. The 84 calls turned into, or the 84 searches turned into one search, which could have been detrimental to her. And I agree with the judge. I was there too, sideline coaching, and I knew that there was no way possible that the jury, based on the evidence, could have legitimately found her guilty. So, what Mr. Padillo is saying, I respect it. I think that he has some other inside information that the public may not have been privy to. But I also think that a large part of his testament and his belief is based on, what the prosecution attempted to build as it was a cover-up. Something happened, and when the cover-up unraveled, they rolled their daughter under the bus. That's what I believe.
Wow. Okay, y'all, we're going to go back to the phone lines, area code 512. And 415, I'm not sure if you were finished with your question. I'll come back to you. Area code 512, 739. Good evening. You're on center stage.
A couple of things. First of all, I'm really happy with what I'm hearing from the doctor. Carrie here, and I also host the Blog Talk Radio show. Good job, Carrie. You're doing awesome, and I'm really glad to see you.
You
got this topic going, and I'm even more pleased to see that you have a doctor that, she's getting it, and it sounds like she's done a little bit of research, too, and I've done an extreme amount of
on this particular case?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, tell us what you know.
Well, I can't really just lay out what I know because I have 2 months worth of extreme investigating.
Okay.
So, I mean, you could do any topic, and I'll tell you what I know. But one thing I would like to comment on, and first of all, I don't know how to reach this doctor, and I would love it if she would call in and be on my show as well, and you can look that up. It's my hometown. But anyway, that George Anthony was involved.
Send me an email and I'll hook you up with the doctor, but go ahead, you were saying what else?
Yeah, okay, cool. I was saying, it's very clear and very obvious that George Anthony was involved. And from our viewpoint, and like I said, I've investigated this a lot, so I have a lot of, I don't want to say evidence, but I will say staff. Casey was indeed at the house on the morning of the 16th. And if you look at the scene map, you'll see.
Okay, we're saying 15th of June, 15th of July, 15th of what?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so from what I can piece together, the only thing that makes absolute sense is we can go ahead and we can set aside how she died. Relevant in terms of understanding his involvement,
mm-hmm.
pick it up just a little bit after she died. So let's just say that on the 16th, they were there, and somehow the baby died. And we don't know if it was an accident. We don't know if it was murder, because that absolutely has not been proven.
Right.
So we do know she died. We know that the 16th, the 15th is the last day that anybody spoke with Bob.
Right.
Haley. So let's say she died that morning, somewhere in around before 2, because that is when there's going to be a gap in any kind of activity at all, whether it's the laptop, the desktop, the phone, texting, whatever. And this is very unusual behavior for Casey. And then next thing the way I see it is, Cindy was not there. And
when the child died, Cindy was not home. Okay.
Cindy was not home on the 16th. Now, I don't know, Carrie, if you've been able to hear the radio interview that Dana did the next morning after the verdict. This is a second cousin of Cindy Anthony. She lives in Houston, and she had called in to a radio station in Houston. I've got the link, and I can send that to you later. But she called in, and she had said, and I believe this 100%, And I have a lot of supporting followers that feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that until the night before, and so she was speaking of the night of the verdict, because this was in the next day. She says, until the last night, we believe, and she said that she was calling for Cindy Anthony's side of the town, and not George.
Mm-hmm.
She said that prior to this phone call that she received, she didn't say who called her, but I'm thinking it was Cindy.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not support her. And then, after these phone calls, she was ecstatic that they believed that everything Jose Byer said in his opening statement was true. Now, I'm not going to take it that far, but I will go as far as to believe what I've seen proven. Now, with all that said, the way that I feel is, if that's the case, then after Haley had died, that would have meant, because this this woman says that on when he died, when George walked out, supposedly by his own statement was that George came around and the baby was limp in his arms. And at that moment, Casey fell to the ground and began to cry hysterically and over and over and was inconsolable. The cousin Dana has said that the caller, the phone call that she had confirmed that, that when she had collapsed like that, that it was an utter mental breakdown beyond something that she would ever recover from. So you believe that, and you could believe that, you know, maybe she was literally inconsolable, maybe in a fetal position, say, for 2 or 3 hours. Now, during that time, I believe that George Anthony made the decision to bag up her body. All right.
Okay. Okay. Let me tell you, because we gotta move on in a second. But are you saying that all? I mean, did you say that Dad and Casey were home at the time that Kaylee died?
Yes.
And so you believe Casey and her father came up with this idea of what they needed to do in order to cover this up?
No, I'm saying George came up with it while he was inconsolable and he couldn't even communicate with
us. Okay, if George is a police officer and had been a detective, then he had to know that there's cases in which people die accidentally. So why would he say the child did not die accidentally and choose to instead do it this way? That doesn't make sense.
You know what?
Can I answer?
Yeah. Go ahead, Doctor.
Can I answer that? You know, looking at their family dynamics, you know, their family dynamics, and the judge alluded to it, their family dynamics are awful. And, you know, I was able to catch the part of the trial where their family was testifying, where George was testifying, Cindy was testifying, and then I read about the brother's testimony. Their family is dysfunctional. So, as an example, if something happens at their home, say Kaylee drowns in the pool, as is a speculation. They find her in the pool, there's a level of stigma that's attached to that neglect. Even if it's an accident, there's a level of stigma that's attached to the fact that a child dies on your watch. There's also a level of ego discomfort that comes with that. And if you're concerned about your image and your family's image, then you're not always in, you know, we kind of talked about this. You know, we're talking as people with normal conscience and ability to process things normally. But when you have a family and when they talked about her mother and her pregnancy and how her mom was in denial about the pregnancy, you know, these are things that pose the threat of threatening your status. So if you're not balanced, you know, admitting and dealing with the ego discomfort and it's really deep of knowing that someone that you love died on your watch can force you into creating a situation where you move from being one type of victim to another type of victim. And I completely agree with the caller. I know that, you know, Casey, from what I've seen, I don't know her, but I definitely think that she has issues with lying. Do I think that she was a willing accomplice in the cover-up to her daughter's accident? Absolutely not. The dynamic also of a father and a mother so actively and willingly and hostily disengaging from their daughter and accusing their daughter of murder without any kind of empathy for her whatsoever, that's problematic. That's dysfunctional.
One thing I found in research, it says that the Anthony's computer showed searches including neck breaking.
Let me tell you what that was about.
Okay.
Casey Anthony. Let me go back a little further than that. When Cindy was living in Ohio, and she met this charming police officer who was on the county sheriff's office, Cindy was living, you might say, on the wrong side of the tracks, even though she was a nurse. This officer was married. He ended up in the hospital. She was caring for him. His family was fairly well-to-do. They owned several new car agencies in the area. They hooked up. They got married. They had a couple children. But still, there was a problem. She wasn't accepted on that side of the tracks. They moved to Florida. In Florida, she became, after she took the wheels off her house, very respectable. She worked at a medical center. He had retired and gotten himself a job at some security offices, And inside that house was a Leave It to Beaver resident. I have never met a more spotless, more clean, more everything in its place house, and I've been in houses a million times.
Really?
It was always on the right side of everything in that house. The dogs were even quite properly. Everything was perfect. When her daughter didn't graduate from high school, she had a graduation party. You're right. If you talk to Rick, she denied 7 months pregnancy. No, she's retaining water. When we got there, everything was told to us, and we told them, that's fine. You tell us anything you want, but we're going to check ourselves to make sure. We're going to verify.
But what does that have to do with neck breaking?
Okay, getting to the neck breaking thing. Casey comes up with a story and tells James, my parents are getting a divorce. This was right before the child disappeared. They're getting a divorce, and mother says I can take over the payments on the house. Now, she doesn't even have a job, but she's telling Amy that she's going to take over the payments on the house. Remember when Judge Perry said something to the effect he quipped? Hey, she probably was thinking of killing her parents? He couldn't have been closer to the truth. Casey was going to kill her parents and end up with the house. In Casey's own mind, the way she operates and the way she thinks, that was a natural scheme. She killed the parents. All she has to do is step in and take over the payments. In order to take over the payments, she just needs a roommate that'll help make some of the rent payment, make it a house payment.
That is crazy. Let me interject, because I
Judge Perry himself said it on the bench.
When I was listening to this and looking at the family, we usually think of mental illness as taboo. I think that there should have been some treatment for mental illness probably for each of those family members. Casey has never been treated, or if she has, the parents have denied, in denial. And so all of this stems from, there's a great issue of mental illness among all of them, though, in their family, and particularly even the brother, who addressed the fact that when his little sister was pregnant, he felt like he was abandoned by his parents because they were giving her, paying attention to her. But the mental illness that Casey has gone through demonstrates her actions as an adult. And if she doesn't feel the empathy and sincereness and when death and act like a normal person, that's because in our household she's been treated like that, and they have been taught to suppress those feelings. And I don't know, the doctor probably won't have the proper term for it, but you can see that. I can see that.
And now what she's going to have to deal with is
acquitting. So we have the stress and the pressure of the media, the negativity, the lot of dislike. Is she going to be able to have enough self-confidence, enough self-esteem to overcome this, or is she going into a great depressive mode and doing something as bad to herself?
Let me see if I can explain.
I'm going to give interviews. I don't think she's giving interviews that's going to highlight some of the things that you said, Mr. Padilla, because she's not going to be telling the truth.
No, she's not. She never.
Can I interject, though? I'm sorry, Mr. Padilla. I just got to get this in. I don't even know the young lady, but, you know, I don't know why I have a level of empathy for her, but I guess it's because, you know, I'm with Baez, and I really do not believe that she murdered her child.
In her mind, it was an accident.
No, I'm saying to you, Mr. Padillo, that I do not believe that Casey Anthony murdered her daughter, period. I do not believe that happened. I strongly believe, even based on, you know, and the judges is more of this than me. I'm an analyst, but I'm not an attorney. I believe that, like, in many cases, there was a rush to put the pieces of Kaylee's death together because nobody was going to tell the truth. I believe that it was an accident. I believe that she drowned in the pool. And even what you said about the home, that solidifies it for me. Because everything that you said about how meticulous they keep things and where they came from, you're talking about developing an image that you need to protect. And when you develop that image so much so that you're in denial about your daughter's pregnancy, or you're in denial about a divorce, or you're in denial about your family dysfunction and you don't want to see, or you're in denial about
about your daughter's failure to complete high school, an accident happens, that type of dynamic is just the dynamic that you need to facilitate, making something up instead of following the normal course of action to call 911 and say there's been an accident in our house, our granddaughter has drowned in our pool, da-da-da, because you don't want to deal with that stigma. And so I strongly believe that the accident happened, and I believe that George and Cindy got together and they concocted this story and they forced Casey to take on this role of perpetuating her daughter being missing. And in the 911 call, you can tell that she is very, very detached from that call. She's very, very detached from what's going on. She has her mother in the background coaching her, but she's very detached about everything except for that 31 days that she knows was the day of her daughter's death. Stuff happened. Hurricanes happened. The story began to unfold. George and Cindy had made it up. They got scared that everything was going to be opened up. And instead of coming clean, they decided that they were going to scapegoat their own daughter. And that's the psychosocial term, scapegoat their own daughter in order to protect their own image. And once she lawyered up, they knew that she was not going to take the stand. She was not going to be able to tell the truth and say what happened, because it would not only implicate her parents, but it would implicate her further as well. And so they rolled her under the bus. And, you know, she may be a liar. I definitely think she has issues. But, you know, I think as humans, kind of, we got to start looking at the reality that just because you have mental health issues and you've been brought up in a dysfunctional family doesn't mean that you're automatically predisposed to being a murderer, especially of your own child.
Okay, speaking of dysfunction, was she molested, Mr. Padilla? Was she molested by her father and her brother, as the defense attorney, Mr. Baez, said?
In my opinion, George did not molest her ever. Did her brother touch her in a brother-sister doctor scene? I don't know. I never went into that. The first time I heard about both of those things was basically a pre-trial, when there were statements that she had made to other people in the jail. And me and knowing George and meeting George, he was a cop. Now, one of the things that a lot of people poke at is the fact as to when he was on the stand. You have to understand that law enforcement officers were people off the street that were looking for a job when they became cops. They're not super intelligent. They're not super anything. They just happen to have a badge and a gun. They do not like to be quizzed. They're the ones that do the asking of questions. They don't like to have questions asked. They're the ones that do the prodding of a fugitive. They're the ones that do the prodding of a suspect. They do not like to be put on the stand. George's testimony was always suspect. When we used to talk to him, and we used to say, George, quit being a cop today. Come on. Just be a dad. Be a grandpa. Talk to us like a grandpa. Tell us what you used to do on a daily basis with your granddaughter. And then we'd go out to the neighborhood and check it. Tell us, George, how did you feel? How did you feel when it was announced that a body had been found? Talk to us, George, about the real things in life. Don't talk to me like a cop. I've been around a million cops. I don't want to hear your answers as a cop. I want to hear him as a grandfather. I want to hear him as a father.
Would he do it?
Yes.
Tell me about the tattoo. There was a tattoo that she got, it appears like on...
July the 4th.
What was the tattoo about? If she didn't do this, if it was a situation in which, you know, it was an accident, why the tattoo?
She showed the tattoo to Casey about the second day that we were there with her.
You mean show this to Tracy?
Casey showed it to Tracy. She says, I got this, now watch this, I got this in memory of my daughter.
Oh, gotcha. Okay,
the second day we were there, there was no...
If the daughter's not dead, what does she mean in memory of her daughter? Because at that point, you all are still searching for what y'all believe to be Kaylee still alive.
Yes, exactly.
Well,
Up until the 27th of August, we really sincerely believed the child was alive. The 27th of August is when everything went down the tubes for us, when the law enforcement announced there was decomposition of human decomposition in the trunk of the car. I get around to human decomposition. Somebody go to a morgue, get a body, stick it in there for a couple of days, you got human decomposition. But they also announced here with the death band that can only be one of the females in the family. I told Cindy, I can get around decomposition, I cannot get around the hair with the dead man. There's one other thing that was never brought up in the trial.
Okay.
At that time, law enforcement said there was 2.6 days of decomposition in the trunk of the car.
Mm-hmm. What does 2.6 mean?
They couldn't understand the 2.6 days of decomposition in the trunk of the car.
Mm.
That didn't fit into their testimony timeline. Therefore, they just didn't talk about it. You go back and listen to those announcements as to the 27th of August.
Okay.
Got it and said, it is in remembrance of my daughter.
Sure.
Well, not a memory of a photograph. Right. Of course, we have different versions of that. That's why a lot of times you just have to listen. You really can't take everything as fact that you hear. And then when people relay it, they may change a word, and that changes
absolutely
the whole content.
Okay,
yo, we're going to go into the timeline for real, because I've been promising this timeline. If you just tune in, you come to Center Stage tonight. We're talking about the Casey Anthony file. We're talking to bounty hunter Leonard Padilla, attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, and sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer. Okay, y'all, let's start with June 15th. June 15th is when they say Kaylee was last seen alive by Cindy Anthony. Supposedly she had taken her to her father's retirement home to see the father. It appears on June 21st, Casey Anthony made an entry into her diary in which she said, I haven't been this happy. Then it appears that on June 30th, Casey's car was towed and was taken to this tow yard. And then it seems like on July 2nd, and I'm trying to move quickly through this, that's when she got the tattoo, the Bella Vita tattoo that, you know, like I said, an Italian thing that means beautiful life. Then it appears on July 12th, 2008, is when George and Cindy said they confronted Casey about why they hadn't seen Kaylee for some time. July 15th is when the car was picked up by George Anthony. That's also the day that they reported Kaylee missing. When we listened to the 911 tape, we heard they initially called and said the car is missing, and just kind of, you know, off the cuff said, hey, and by the way, you know, my granddaughter's missing too. There's a smell in the car that looks like somebody died in it. Okay, and then on the 17th of July 2008 is when Casey Anthony was arrested. Police, you know, they said had taken her to the studios where she said she worked. They taken a tour with her and said, take us to your office. And she kind of took them around in a circle for a while before she said, hey, by the way, I don't work here anymore. I used to work here a long time ago. So then they charged her with child neglect, lying to an investigator and interfering with a criminal investigation. And she was denied bond at that time. The 21st of July, that's when someone posted a reward for $150,000 if someone found Kaylee Anthony alive. August 5th is when formal charges were filed against Casey Anthony. August 8th, Casey refused to see her brother. So what's going on at this point, Mr. Padilla? We want you to come back to that as soon as I give this timeline. August 8th, she starts not wanting to have contact with her family. She refused contact with her brother on August 8th. On August 10th, she refused to see her parents. Now this is August 10th. August 8th, she's refusing contact with her family. August 12th is when George said that he believed Kaylee had been kidnapped, and kidnappers were being watched. Why did he tell that lie, Mr. Padilla? We're going to want you to address that. August 17th is when you, Mr. Padilla, arrived in Orlando, Florida. So maybe you can pick up from there what happened. But you arrive, all these things have occurred. What is the mood? What is the atmosphere of Orlando, Florida when you hit the ground?
Well, when we hit the ground, there were six of us.
Mm-hmm.
There was only three of us, two of us that stood out for the crowd, for the media, Tracy, Tony, Toby, Miguel, and Huizinga.
Okay, let's go back over. Tracy is the person who stayed with Casey for 9 days.
She was in the room with her for the 9 days, yeah, 24/7.
When she was bonded out of jail.
Tony Padilla was the bail agent that got her out. He's my nephew. They skirted off to the side. The other three individuals that were with us also skirted off to the other side, leaving me and Rob to deal with the media.
Okay.
That night, we then went to the Anthony home. They were having a vigil. We met Lee. I asked Lee, I introduced myself, having previously talked to Baez half a dozen times on the phone, to get the approval of the family to bail her out and to get her approval to bail out, to find out if the family had it okay. We put her in a safe house. They said, no, they want her to come home. Okay. So we go, we talk to the family. We have a meeting that night for about 4 hours, from about 10 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Let me jump in. You think when you hit the ground, you're looking for a missing child?
Correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, that's what Baez has basically said. And that night, we meet with them, and they say Jesse Grund, who was in love with their daughter, who had lived with the daughter, who knew the baby, who at first thought it was his baby, took a paternity test, turned out it wasn't his baby, he didn't care, he loved that child. The next day, We go to Baez's office. He reinforces that with a birthday card saying, "I love you, two women in my life, the child, the mother." So we're like, okay, this guy probably took the kid and hit her somewhere.
This is Baez, the attorney?
The attorney, Baez. Yes, he has influenced us to think that Jesse Grund had something to do with kidnapping the child.
Okay.
Now, we're not focusing on a nanny, the kidnapper type thing.
So you never believed that?
We're focusing on Jesse Grund the very first, the next day after we're in town.
So the meter reader has already called into the police that he's seen something, and you all think he's a suspect?
We don't even know about the meter reader at that time. We've not even heard about the meter reader.
Okay, go ahead. Jesse,
hold on.
I'm thinking you're meaning Mr. Kronk. You're not talking about the,
I'm thinking you're talking about Roy Kronk. Jesse Grund is the old boyfriend.
Gotcha, okay, I'm sorry. Okay.
Who used to be a cop.
Okay.
Anyhow, so we're talking about Jesse Grund. Immediately, I sent my people out into the neighborhood. I want you to talk to everybody, every resident. I want to know what George's attitude was with his granddaughter. 50 people came back with, oh, yeah, I saw him. He was always pulling her in a little red wagon around the neighborhood, just, you know, walking around. She had a little red wagon. She'd pull her in the red wagon. How does he get along with his wife? I've heard stories. He had an affair. She had an affair. She ran him off. Finally, they got back together after they both settled down on their tit-for-tat affairs. What about the daughter? The daughter's in and out. She supposedly works at Universal or somewhere. We don't know. She's always gone. She's always back. What about moved out of Albuquerque. He now lives with a girlfriend. He's not here anymore. He works for some outfit that rents parking lots for big sporting affairs.
Well, let me jump in right here. One thing that sticks out to me, when you hit the ground, it's 2 months later. The first day of the 911 call, they said that the car smelled like someone had been decomposing in the car. So why is it that you all hit the ground looking for a missing person when in fact the
first
911?
One of the first things we asked George and his wife, and they both said, no, there was rotting pizza in there, et cetera, et cetera. And we had confirmed that on one of the nights there was 3 calls to pizza parlors. And we'd already looked at the pictures of the stuff that was in the trunk of the car, and yeah, there was a ton of garbage in there. My assumption at the time was, okay, George knows the difference between decomposition and rotting garbage. Now, I had not heard his statement regarding him saying that there was decomposition in the trunk. The only thing I'd heard at that point was him telling me, no, I was on the safe cop. I know the difference. It was rotting garbage. Cindy, I'm a nurse. I know the difference. It was rotting garbage. Okay, fair enough. We're okay there so far. A couple days we spent with Baez. He's telling us Jesse Grund's a prime suspect. The family's telling us. We finally get a hold of Jesse Grund, his dad. Now we're perplexed because this guy didn't kidnap anybody. He loved that child. You couldn't talk to him about that child. He broke down crying. Is he a big fake? Has he really got us suckered in? No.
Okay, Jesse Grund is the boyfriend. One thing that no one ever established during this whole trial, and y'all, this is the number one question that has always been on my mind, where is the baby daddy?
Nobody knows, not even she knows.
Oh, y'all. Oh, my
God. She don't even know.
So nowhere in this whole thing did anybody establish who the baby daddy was?
Nope, she don't know. She threw out to us 10 different guys, 10 different possibilities.
Wow.
But she never once said who the baby was. 10 different possibilities she threw at us. I'll tell you why. Because there was times when she was capable of having sex 3 times a day with 3 different guys and never thinking about it. It was just in her nature and wanted adulation so bad that, hey, here I am. Come get me.
So no one ever came forward during this whole trial and said, that could have been my child.
No, I've had a lot of calls from people saying, I think my son was the father. I think my grandson was the father. But nobody, and I've suggested, hey, go take a DNA test. The cops have DNA from the family. They can match it up. To this day, nobody has come forward and said, here it is, proof positive.
Terry, I want to jump in real quick because promiscuity is one of the indicators of sexual abuse. So when you ask, was she molested by her father? I mean, it's not the end all to be all, but promiscuity is one of the principal indicators of being abused as a child. So I do want to point that out, and that's not my opinion.
I'm totally aware of that. Yes.
Well, Mr. Patel,
Carrie, real quick, can I offer my own timeline?
Yeah, go ahead. Why not?
This is my opinion. This is my chain of events. June the 15th, I believe Kaylee drowned. I believe that they wrapped her body and buried her body in the backyard.
Same thing. The third day, Cindy says she wants to talk to you. She came out, And I says, hey, how's it going? You know, and we chatted about several things in general, things that she just tended to lie about but didn't have anything to do with Kaylee. And that's when I told her, hey, when you get through this, and you're going to get through this, you come see me. I need people that can lie as well as you can. And I'll give you a job. And she looked at me, she said, oh, okay.
Let me ask you a question.
The babysitter, Zenaida Gonzalez's story, having took her daughter. By that time, we'd already checked out the Zenaida thing, Jay Blanchard and the whole thing. And I told her, look, I didn't come 3,000 miles and leave my chihuahua behind to listen to this BS. I basically had elected to become the bad guy in the act.
Okay, let me ask you, why is it that she was never engaged in the search? Is it because she was on an electronic monitoring system so she couldn't leave the house?
Nope. Like Tracy says, why go search for somebody if you know they're dead?
So she never said, I want to go search for Kaylee.
Never once.
Wow.
Never mentioned her name except a couple times when they were looking at a scrapbook one time of Kaylee. And she says, Tracy, look at my scrapbook. I'm just as pretty as she was. Was.
Wow. And was that raising any red flags for you all as you're sitting and listening to these things and watching the atmosphere in this particular house? Well, was it like clear to y'all, okay, we made this trip down here thinking we're looking for a missing person when actually we're looking for a dead body?
Ma'am, when I make a mistake, it's usually a pretty good sized one. And at the time of the 27th, when they announced decomposition,
mm-hmm.
I sat there for a good hour, and Rob Dick says to me, have you come up with an exit strategy?
Mm.
And for 2 days, I'm like, what do I do?
Now, was the exit strategy for the media, or was the exit strategy for the family and the defense attorney? What was the exit strategy for? I would have just been out of here.
How do we extract from this situation and admit we screwed up?
Okay.
We jumped the gun. We should have waited.
Wow. And I understand you're possibly going to sue Casey Anthony down the road. What am I understanding that's happening with you and Baez? Is Baez saying that, well, we didn't tell Padilla to get involved, Padilla kind of came down on his own, he and Ed was search, or what is he trying to say exactly?
Baez is saying that we basically, I contacted him.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, guy, I understand. And I did this because I had discussed it with some media people up in New York, and they were following the case. And it's people that I've dealt with on other cases, other missing children cases. I would say that half the cases we get involved in about missing children, law enforcement announces the child's probably dead, and half of them we found the child alive. The other half, they were right. But anyhow, I discussed it with him half a dozen times. He's on his way to New York. He calls me from New York. I'm saying, okay, check with the family. The family's got no money. Don't worry about it. I'll pay the fee. Then it's like, okay, fine. Come on back here. Do your thing. We get back there. We do our thing. Now, by this time, Baez knows the child is dead.
Mm.
Regardless of how the child got there, he knows because she has laid the story on him. I want to tell somebody here that came up with that. That was our original thought.
Mm.
She drowned in the pool and the family was covering.
That was nothing.
The day after the decomposition thing came up, we figured, wow, there it is. Problem. The law enforcement people originally took filters out of the pool.
Mm.
And a lot of, in other words, they took a lot of this stuff to test. One of the things I asked the FBI, did you test the water in 4 minutes of death? Had the body been in the pool any amount of time, decomposition would have shown up in the water unless they had drained the water in the meantime.
Mm.
The answer to me by the FBI guy was, yeah, we tested the water, no decomposition. We thought maybe even so far as to she accidentally killed the child, put her in the pool to make it look like a drowning. It didn't work. She laid her on the grass. That's why the dogs got the hits on the grass.
Yeah, but there's a level. No. In a big pool, there's a level of decomposition that has to occur in order for it to be measurable. And 4 minutes does not emit the level of decomposition that they would be able to adequately measure in a large pool. I mean, that would have to take time. So if they found her body within an hour. Okay. And then also I wanted to ask you, Mr. Padillo, you know, everybody, George is the hero, or, you know, he's the victim, but then you're still talking about 31 days. What grandfather loves their grandchild so much, and then you haven't seen them in the 31 days, and you don't even think to make a phone call?
calls to your police buddies that you know would help you to look for your daughter and your granddaughter. You know, we have to also understand, where did 911 calls from Casey Anthony's family during the 31 days that they proclaimed that she was missing?
Here's the thing. George and Cindy were having so many problems between themselves. He was having problems with his new job. She was having problems with his affair. He was having problems with her tit-for-tat affair. They were having these, every time that they asked her, and if you go back and you can fill in all 31 days, she's with the babysitter at the beach. She's down in Tampa because the babysitter had a car wreck, and I had to go down there because she was in the hospital. Oh, and she went to an outing. You go back and just concentrate on the stories that she told law enforcement, that she told her parents, and the parents related to law enforcement. It fills in all 31 days she had stories for where that child was. The parents were so embroiled in their own mess, their own life falling apart, that whatever she gave them as an excuse, they were willing to readily accept. Now, around the 4th of July...
But that's assuming that the stories that she gave to the police to support the story that the parents came up with was actually what she told her parents, because that doesn't mean, just because she gave that as an account to the police does not mean that that's what she was actually telling her parents.
Well, if you
because
go back and look at some of the things she told the cops.
Where is the concrete evidence that shows that she was actually away from the home for those 31 days?
Okay, y'all, listen, we got 90 seconds left. Wow.
Thank you so much for listening. Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night.